Chrome Yellow by Aldous Huxley. Read for LibriVox.org by Martin Clifton. Chapter 25. "I hope you all realise," said Henry Wimbush during dinner, "that next Monday is bank holiday, and you'll all be expected to help in the fair." "Heavens!" cried Anne. "The fair! I'd forgotten all about it. What a nightmare! Couldn't you put a stop to it, Uncle Henry?" Mr. Wimbush sighed and shook his head. "Alas," he said, "I fear I cannot. I should have liked to put an end to it years ago, but the claims of charity are strong." "It's not charity we want," Anne murmured rebelliously, "it's justice." "Besides," Mr. Wimbush went on, "the fair has become an institution. Let me see, it must be 22 years since we started it. It was a modest affair then. Now..." He made a sweeping movement with his hand and was silent. It spoke highly for Mr. Wimbush's public spirit that he still continued to tolerate the fair. Beginning as a sort of glorified church bazaar, Crome's yearly charity fair had grown into a noisy thing of merry-go-rounds, coconut shies, and miscellaneous sideshows. A real, genuine fair on the grand scale. It was the local St. Bartholomew, and the people of all the neighbouring villages, with even a contingent from the county town, flocked into the park for their bank holiday amusement. The local hospital profited handsomely, and it was this fact alone which prevented Mr. Wimbush, to whom the fair was a cause of recurrent and never-diminishing agony, from putting a stop to the nuisance which yearly desecrated his park and garden. "I've made all the arrangements already," Henry Wimbush went on. "Some of the larger marquees will be put up tomorrow. The swings and the merry-go-round arrive on Sunday." "So there's no escape," said Anne, turning to the rest of the party. "You'll all have to do something. As a special favour, you're allowed to choose your slavery. My job is the tea-tent, as usual. Aunt Priscilla..." "My dear," said Mrs. Wimbush, interrupting her, "I have more important things to think about than the fair. But you need have no doubt that I shall do my best when Monday comes to encourage the villagers." "That's splendid," said Anne. "Aunt Priscilla will encourage the villagers. What will you do, Mary?" "I won't do anything where I have to stand by and watch other people eat." "Then you'll look after the children's sports." "All right," Mary agreed, "I'll look after the children's sports." "And Mr. Scogan?" Mr. Scogan reflected. "May I be allowed to tell fortunes?" he asked at last. "I think I should be good at telling fortunes." "But you can't tell fortunes in that costume." "Can't I?" Mr. Scogan surveyed himself. "You'll have to be dressed up. Do you still persist?" "I'm ready to suffer all indignities." "Good," said Anne, and turned to Gombauld. "You must be our lightning artist," she said. "Your portrait for a shilling in 5 minutes." "It's a pity I'm not Ivor," said Gombauld with a laugh. "I could throw in a picture of their auras for an extra sixpence." Mary flushed. "Nothing is to be gained," she said severely, "by speaking with levity of serious subjects. And, after all, whatever your personal views may be, psychical research is a perfectly serious subject." "And what about Dennis?" Dennis made a deprecating gesture. "I have no accomplishments," he said. "I'll just be one of those men who wear a thing in their buttonholes and go about telling people which is the way to tea and not to walk on the grass." "No, no," said Anne, "that won't do. You must do something more than that." "But what? All the good jobs are taken, and I can do nothing but lisp in numbers." "Well, then, you must lisp," concluded Anne. "You must write a poem for the occasion, an ode on bank holiday. We'll print it on Uncle Henry's press and sell it at tuppence a copy." "Sixpence," Dennis protested. "It'll be worth sixpence." Anne shook her head. "Tuppence," she repeated firmly. "Nobody will pay more than tuppence." "And now there's Jenny," said Mr. Wimbush. "Jenny," he said, raising his voice, "what will you do?" Dennis thought of suggesting that she might draw caricatures at sixpence an execution, but decided it would be wiser to go on feigning ignorance of her talent. His mind reverted to the red notebook. Could it really be true that he looked like that? "What I will do," Jenny echoed, "what I will do," she frowned thoughtfully for a moment. Then her face brightened and she smiled. "When I was young," she said, "I learned to play the drums." "The drums?" Jenny nodded, and in proof of her assertion, agitated her knife and fork like a pair of drumsticks over her plate. "If there's any opportunity of playing the drums," she began. "But of course," said Anne, "there's any amount of opportunity. We'll put you down definitely for the drums. That's the lot," she added. "And a very good lot, too," said Gombauld. "I look forward to my bank holiday. It ought to be gay." "It ought, indeed," Mr. Scogan assented, "but you may rest assured that it won't be. No holiday is ever anything but a disappointment." "Come, come," protested Gombauld, "my holiday at Crome isn't being a disappointment."
"Isn't it?"
Anne turned an ingenuous mask towards him.
"No, it isn't," he answered.
"I'm delighted to hear it."
"It's in the very nature of things," Mr. Scogan went on. "Our holidays can't help being disappointments. Reflect for a moment. What is a holiday? The ideal, the platonic holiday of holidays is surely a complete and absolute change."
"You agree with me in my definition?" Mr. Scogan glanced from face to face round the table. His sharp nose moved in a series of rapid jerks through all the points of the compass. There was no sign of dissent. He continued, "A complete and absolute change. Very well. But isn't a complete and absolute change precisely the thing we can never have? Never, in the very nature of things?"
Mr. Scogan once more looked rapidly about him.
"Of course it is. As ourselves, as specimens of Homo sapiens, as members of a society, how can we hope to have anything like an absolute change? We are tied down by the frightful limitation of our human faculties, by the notions which society imposes on us through our fatal suggestibility, by our own personalities. For us, a complete holiday is out of the question. Some of us struggle manfully to take one, but we never succeed. If I may be allowed to express myself metaphorically, we never succeed in getting farther than Southend."
"You're depressing," said Anne.
"I mean to be," Mr. Scogan replied, and expanding the fingers of his right hand, he went on, "Look at me, for example. What sort of a holiday can I take? In endowing me with passion and faculties, nature has been horribly niggardly. The full range of human potentialities is, in any case, distressingly limited. My range is a limitation within a limitation. Out of the 10 octaves that make up the human instrument, I can compass perhaps 2. Thus, while I may have a certain amount of intelligence, I have no aesthetic sense. While I possess the mathematical faculty, I am wholly without the religious emotions. While I am naturally addicted to venery, I have little ambition and am not at all avaricious. Education has further limited my scope. Having been brought up in society, I am impregnated with its laws. Not only should I be afraid of taking a holiday from them, I should also feel it painful to try to do so. In a word, I have a conscience as well as a fear of jail. Yes, I know it by experience. How often have I tried to take holidays, to get away from myself, my own boring nature, my insufferable mental surroundings," Mr. Scogan sighed. "But always without success," he added, "always without success. In my youth I was always striving, how hard, to feel religiously and aesthetically. Here," said I to myself, "are 2 tremendously important and exciting emotions. Life would be richer, warmer, brighter, altogether more amusing if I could feel them. I try to feel them. I read the works of the mystics. They seem to me nothing but the most deplorable claptrap, as indeed they always must to anyone who does not feel the same emotion as the authors felt when they were writing. For it is the emotion that matters. The written work is simply an attempt to express emotion, which is in itself inexpressible, in terms of intellect and logic. The mystic objectifies a rich feeling in the pit of the stomach into a cosmology. For other mystics, that cosmology is a symbol of the rich feeling. For the unreligious, it is a symbol of nothing, and so appears merely grotesque. A melancholy fact, but I divagate." Mr. Scogan checked himself. "So much for the religious emotion. As for the aesthetic, I was at even greater pains to cultivate that. I have looked at all the right works of art in every part of Europe. There was a time when, I venture to believe, I knew more about Taddeo di Poggibonsi, more about the cryptic Amico di Taddeo, even than Henry does. Today, I am happy to say, I have forgotten most of the knowledge I then so laboriously acquired. But without vanity, I can assert that it was prodigious. I don't pretend, of course, to know anything about nigger sculpture or the later 17th century in Italy, but about all the periods that were fashionable before 1900 I am, or was, omniscient. Yes, I repeat it, omniscient. But did that fact make me any more appreciative of art in general? It did not. Confronted by a picture, of which I could tell you all the known and presumed history, the date when it was painted, the character of the painter, the influences that had gone to make it what it was,
I felt none of that strange excitement and exaltation which is, as I am informed by those who do feel it, the true aesthetic emotion. I felt nothing but a great weariness of spirit. Nevertheless, I must have gone on looking at pictures for 10 years before I would honestly admit to myself that they merely bored me. Since then, I have given up all attempts to take a holiday. I go on cultivating my old stale daily self in the resigned spirit with which a bank clerk performs from 10 till 6 his daily task. A holiday, indeed. I'm sorry for you, Gombauld, if you still look forward to having a holiday. Gombauld shrugged his shoulders. Perhaps, he said, my standards aren't as elevated as yours. But personally I found the war quite as thorough a holiday from all the ordinary decencies and sanities, all the common emotions and preoccupations, as I ever wanted to have. Yes, Mr. Scogan thoughtfully agreed, yes, the war was certainly something of a holiday. It was a step beyond Southend, it was Weston-super-Mare, it was almost Ilfracombe. End of chapter.